Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols, and alongside me today is Jason Henricks. We're recording this week's show live in Orlando at BAI Beacon. We facilitated a C-suite summit yesterday, and I'm hosting the Global Innovation Awards, and Jason is also speaking on agility in the modern enterprise. And conveniently enough, today's show is brought to you by Fintech Forge. That's the company that Jason and I founded to help banks build and extend their innovation capacity in a way that drives real results fast. You don't need to create a lab or an incubator to be innovative. Our proprietary FIRE methodology, which stands for Fast, Iterative, Responsive Experiments, allows institutions to move fast, promote learning, all while balancing risk. Want to learn more? Check out our site at ftforge.com. Well, we have just a couple of conference announcements as we're winding down the 2018 conference season as we sit here at BAI Beacon. Finovate Asia is coming up on October 29th and 30th as a part of Hong Kong FinTech Week, and I'll be there along with 20 demoing companies and over 450 attendees, so I'm looking forward to taking the FinTech stage once again. We're already looking ahead to April of 2019. We are the podcast partner of Seamless Middle East. That's coming up April 10th and 11th in Dubai. Seamless is a dynamic summit and a large-scale exhibition bringing together the converging worlds of e-commerce, retail, payments, fintech, and identity. It's a two-day conference and tickets are $1,500, but our listeners receive a 50% discount on the current early bird rate of $1,000 until December 23rd. So that means you can get a two-day conference pass for $500, saving $1,000 for the final ticket price. I guess you can invest the rest in Bitcoin or your favorite cryptocurrency. You can learn more and register at seamless-expo.com/ME. Seamless-expo.com/ME for Middle East. If you have something you want to share with our audience, hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1, or you can email us at info@provoke.fm. Well, Jason, today's show is themed Funding Fintech's Future, Workhorses versus Unicorns. So we got a lot in today's title. So the first part, let's talk about...
It is a mouthful.
Yeah. Well, maybe let's start at the end. So what is the difference between a workhorse and a unicorn?
Well, you know, one of the things, people sometimes forget because we're the radio personalities now and we talk about innovation, but in my background, I've both been a venture capitalist, a corporate venture capitalist, and I'm still active as an angel investor. And one of the things I find interesting as I look at the venture market is there is a tendency to look at the, I want to invest in the next Facebook, the Instagram, these high flyers where you get the 100-to-1, very flashy, you know, short of return on investment. And then there are other VCs, and this was me as a VC, I tended to invest in, turned out the less sexy the business, the better I tended to do. And so today's segment, as we were setting it up, you know, wanted to talk with, you know, first you obviously, but then Matt Harris of Bain Capital Ventures, who's one of the most proliferate and best regarded fintech investors. And then Kat Udrek, who both as an investment banker had focused on financial services, and then now as a VC does. And they're both pretty interesting, especially Matt, because he has a delicate balance of these high flyers, some of the most successful venture exits within financial services, but also really looks at some of the deeper, less sexy plumbing aspects with a deep expertise. And so I wanted to really break that down, the difference between the high flyers and the less sexy plumbing companies.
Okay. And then the other part, funding fintech's future. So
both Kat and Matt, the rhyming unintentional
yes,
here.
This is the at show today.
Yeah. Both focused from externally. But one of the things that we have both been seeing in the last year or so is the rise of corporate venture capital inside financial services, not just the large super banks, but some regional financial institutions, some community banks, actually.
Even the smaller banks, right? Like we're seeing this a lot. A bunch of banks in that 1 to 5 billion, some even smaller, are actually getting active in investing in fintech companies.
Yeah, that's right. They're wanting to make equity investments, not just partner, but actually own a piece of the pie. So first of all, what's the difference between corporate venture capital and an outside venture capital? Do you treat the investment different? Do you treat your pool of funds differently?
Well, we could go the rest of the show on this alone, but I'd say the first thing to think about is, CVC or corporate venture capital is often known as strategic investment when you're on the receiving side of it. And the strategic word in strategic investment is really important because venture capitalists are investing for financial reasons. They have investors themselves and are looking to generate purely a financial return. And when you look at a strategic investor, the corporate venture capital firm, they need to actually extract more than just a financial return. In fact, the financial return is often secondary. It's that strategic value they're looking for. And this is one of my favorite stories to tell on CVC, is giving a talk at the National Convention of Corporate Venture Capitalists. And my talk was all about, if you don't have a plan for extracting strategic value, you are the dumb money. And let's just say I was not very popular and I ate a alone that day, except for one or two who came over, because it's easy to start to think about the investing, right? There are lots of people internally who fancy themselves the gunslingers of venture capital. But how do you actually make that investment strategic is one of the hardest things, not just making a financial investment, but how do we make it a strategic investment?
So strategic meaning it complements or supplements or improves what I'm already investing my corporate funds in, right? My core business and some of the things that I'm already trying to do.
Yes, what you're already trying to do. And it really begins with asking yourself, why do you want to do it? And there's several reasons. You might want exposure to a market that you either serve today and you want to see how a startup is approaching it, or it's a market you don't serve. It's exploratory. This is your buoy in the ocean telling you what direction the tides are going. You might want exposure to technology, a different customer set. It might actually be about deepening a partnership. Is this a company or a startup you've partnered with and you want to share in the upside, right? Nothing aligns your interest like actually having not just an investment of time and energy, but dollars into the company to really align your interests.
How do you get started when you're working with these banks and other financial institutions that say, hey, we want to get into the investment game? Where do we start?
Well, let's start with the worst way to get into the game, which is you have a deal and say, ooh, I want to get into corporate venture capital. That does not work out well from this whole idea of being a strategic investor. You need to start with your strategy of why do we want to do this? And after you've answered that, there's a couple other decisions to go through. So first, what's inbounds and out of bounds? Are there certain markets that you would just never do? Like, would you invest in a cannabis company or a crypto company? Is that inbounds for you or out of bounds? Would you do something that actually might cannibalize your business? Are you investing in something that is potentially competitive because you want to understand it? Or do you want to stay away from those? Do you actually want to focus solely on the workhorses, the ones who are building products that better serve you? You need to think about the stage of company. Are you comfortable investing in something that is losing money and will likely need to raise more money? Or do you want to invest in something later stage, which is a lot more predictable? You also have to think about how much are you allocating? One of the worst things you can actually do is make just a single investment, not do an entire portfolio. And then, that's a lot like buying a lottery ticket. And I'd say the last thing is, will you do follow-on investments? If they need more money, will you be participating? There's more upside. One of my early mentors in venture capital said, there's only two kinds of investments, those you want to own all of and those you want to own none of. And unfortunately, it costs you several million dollars to find out which one you just invested in. So you have to be comfortable with the idea, I might have to put more money into it to protect my position and to fund the company. Or you might say, hey, we've de-risked it and I want more money because I want more financial return. So those are some of the first decisions you really need to think through internally, as well as who's going to actually be doing this. Most banks don't have this expertise. It is very different than analyzing a plan and a balance sheet and financials for an operating company in the same way that we'd look to make a loan to.
Right. I'm going to come back and ask you to talk a little bit more about that. Building on your point of kind of starting with a purpose, I just published a blog post this week about what we like to call a declaration of innovation. And it's really similar advice when we're talking to financial institutions about, hey, we need to be more innovative. Okay, well, what does that mean? What's the who, what, when, where, how, and why of your innovation strategy? And I think part of what you're saying is your corporate venture capital strategy needs to answer the same sorts of questions.
Same sorts of questions. The worst reason to be getting into strategic investing and being a corporate venture capital is because it seems like a cool idea. You know, I think about the first time I visited Silicon Valley in the late 90s. And I was an entrepreneur in Boston, which obviously has a very big entrepreneurial and venture scene. But I show up in Silicon Valley and every other person I met was, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm an entrepreneur. Fast forward to, you know, by the time you get to the mid 2000s and it still continues today, everyone's, I want to be a venture capitalist. I want to be a venture capitalist, and see this, you know, not just within banks and financial institutions, see this within all sorts of large enterprises where they're like, ooh, we want to get into CVC, the lure of making these investments and making tons of money, you know, coming out of it is very real and it's very seductive and dangerous.
So I know how to invest my company's own capital. I have spreadsheets and J-curves and IRR calculations, and I certainly know how to make loans. So why can't I just turn that on and take a piece of that capital and turn it into corporate venture capital?
Well, you absolutely can. And one of the things that would definitely recommend is allocate a piece, not while you're looking at a deal, but saying, here's the pool, here's the number of deals I want to do over what time period. Would recommend you end up with at least 8 to 10 deals in the portfolio. Divide by, you know, the number of deals you want to do, and don't invest more than that to start, and probably a little bit of reserves behind it. But when you get to the analysis, right, you need to recognize this is very different than a loan. These companies have very short operating histories. In fact, the only part that's very predictable is the amount of money they lose. And there's nothing quite like going into a board meeting and say, we have good news, bad news. The bad news is revenue is far behind plan. The good news is we're right on our expense plan. It's like, that's not good news. If revenue is not coming as we expect, I want you to scale back. Well, you know, that's not how you look at a loan. When you're making an investment in the financials, you're actually looking at an operating history that is relatively predictable, except for some catastrophic events, right? That's what generates our losses. You know, the loss rate on an investment, you're lucky if over half of your investments return the money you put into them, right? And now if you had a loan officer that only half their loans actually return the principal, that would probably pretty quickly be an ex-loan officer.
Yeah, and perhaps an ex-bank.
Yeah, an ex-bank as well.
So we've talked about that a lot, the need to be right 99% of the time in our lending decisions over time. And that's nowhere near the kind of percentage that any kind of equity investor is making. But I think you also hit on something important, and it's the nature of those companies and the valuation of those companies. So we've been in lots of conversations with bankers and others around the industry who really don't understand the valuation of an earlier stage company. And it's not the same thing as discounted cash flow.
Oh, that's one of my absolute favorites. If it's either the entrepreneur or the investor who comes to me with the valuations based on a DCF, and I love asking, it's like, what'd you use for the discount rate, right? What's your cost of capital there? And, you know, when they come out with something in like the low teens, which is what you'd give as a WACC for actually a public company, right? A lot of them, you're kind of like, well, actually, based on the amount of risk in this, the WACC should probably be closer to infinite. So your company is worth, you know, absolutely nothing. Another mentor of mine, so when I was getting into the business, any VC on either coast who would let me buy them a cup of coffee, and I promised them, it's like, I just want your wisdom, and as soon as the coffee is gone, I will leave your office, I promise. And I never will forget this piece of advice. Really well-known Silicon Valley investor looked at me, he goes, you know, when you make the investment, the real value is probably negative. right? But it turns out that's not very motivating to entrepreneurs to tell them that their company is worthless. And so at the end of the day, how is the price set if not by, you know, doing a DCF or the amount of money that's been put into it, or, oh, let's look at the comparables. Let's look at what Facebook did in its first round or some of the other, you know, famous exits. The reality is the price is set by what the startup is willing to sell for and investors are willing to buy for. And it's, you know, just like any other market, that it is relatively efficient, that you will find what an investor is willing to invest at when they look at its exit potential and how much it needs to raise over time, where they will actually go set the price. But there's nothing funnier than seeing the DCF version of this.
So how do you help these, you know, bankers and corporate minds who are used to looking at stabilized cash flow, established enterprises, kind of reorient their thinking to think about these earlier stage companies where so much of that is unproven?
Well, and this is one of the advantages that strategic investors have. When I put on my hat as a CVC, you know, I would look at it and say, okay, we're interested in being a customer of this company. How many other corporates are out there like me? In fact, oftentimes I would introduce them even to some of our competitors that were, you know, potentially customers of this and say, hey, what do you think of this? Are you interested in potentially buying their service or software? Because if they were interested and I'm interested, that's a pretty good sign. As a venture capitalist, that was always the kind of diligence you want. You know, the number one question is, you know, what's in your sales pipeline? How close are they closing? And when can I talk to them? And, you know, the entrepreneur, of course, is skittish. It's like, I don't want you talking to my customers yet, you know, because I don't want you to fully understand, well, you know, particularly with our banker hat on, it's like, how big is the problem? Well, the problem is big. When are you going to buy? Sometime. What's the process? Well, they have to go through vendor management and procurement and risk and all of this stuff. And so now suddenly it's an 18 to 20 month, you know, prospect. That's pretty scary as a VC looking at that length of sales cycle. But you have an advantage if you're a strategic, because you know what that sales cycle is going to be internally.
So if I'm a strategic investor, do I need to be a customer of the company I'm investing in?
You don't need to be, although, you know, certainly if you're looking to deepen the partnership, you probably should be. You know, if you're looking at workhorses, hey, if you're not willing to be a customer, but you want to be an investor in this company and they're, you know, solving a pain point you have internally and you're not buying, that's probably a pretty negative sign if you're not actually purchasing. But if you're just looking for exposure to a market or a technology or a customer segment, I don't think you actually have to be a customer. Nor do you even need to be a partner with them if you're just looking for exposure to some of this. You know, I think about blockchain is a great example where you might make an investment because you want to learn more about how the technology is being deployed. Or if you're looking at, you know, within wealth management or insurance and some of these adjacent businesses that you're just trying to understand better.
Well, we talked to somebody yesterday that relatively, you know, small to mid-sized bank that made an investment in blockchain and creating their own cryptocurrency. And they said they spent probably $20,000 in interns in really just coding to learn some use cases. I mean, how do you view that as an investment?
Well, I mean, that really was an investment in learning. No financial return, pure strategic, not even, you know, wouldn't call it in the corporate venture capital realm. But it was a really savvy investment in learning where they didn't just sponsor a hackathon or throw their logo up on an incubator and, you know, kind of beat their chest and say, look how innovative we are. And they got real learning at the end of it, you know, for the low cost of $20,000 and a bunch of hours. They have a deep understanding of actually how blockchain and cryptocurrencies could be used. And they've translated that into a real world application for smart contracts of how they're running part of their lending operation. I thought it was a very savvy investment.
Well, if I decide I want to start corporate venture capital investing, why don't I just take whatever part of that capital I'm going to invest and put it into a fund with some great venture capitalist?
Well, I mean, that's a great way to get financial return. And you know, speaking candidly, as much as I have heard venture investors say, oh, you know, we're going to give you all sorts of strategic insight for doing this. The reality is if you are a pure financial investor and you have other limited partners who are purely investing for financial returns, right? That just actually kind of pulls you in two directions, because any energy I'm investing in generating a strategic return for you, I'm doing a disservice to the financial investor. So more often than not, I find that's just lip service. And so if you really are in it because you want the strategic aspect, you really do need to look at making investments yourselves directly and having a plan for extracting the strategic value.
But what if I don't have the scale? What if I'm only going to invest a couple of $1 million? And as you talked about spreading that over 8 or 10 deals, that means my individual investments get pretty small.
Yeah, you probably remember this, or maybe you're teeing me up for this, the discussion we had a few years ago with that community bank, and the investment banker who introduced us said, oh, you should talk to Jason if you want to do strategic investing in your bank. And asked him, it's like, well, you know, how much are you looking to invest? And like $1 to $2 million. And how many deals do you think you're going to do? Well, 8 to 10. I'm like, wow, you know, for a, you know, sub $5 billion bank, you know, building out, you know, 8 to 10 deals at 1 to 2, you know, we're talking a $15 to $20 million venture portfolio. And they're like, oh, no. That was 1 to 2 million total. I'm like, well, wait a second. So you're talking about investing 100 to 200,000. You don't have economies of scale. Do you have anyone internally who has the expertise? Well, no. And are you going to hire someone? It's like, well, we don't have budget for that. And do you think you actually get, you know, the attention of the company, you know, if you're making a $100,000 investment relative to, you know, the raising $5 to $7 million? The reality is you're probably not getting that level of investment in return on the strategic value. So one of the things I think banks need to think long and hard about is how do they actually get that economies of scale, both in expertise and in their ability to actually influence the direction of a company. And that's one of the places that I think credit unions have done some interesting stuff, right? When they invest through a CUSO, or they actually create and fully own the CUSO, this idea of pooling, right? Especially when you look at something like a workhorse, it's one of the things I'm most excited about, is if you can get groups of banks to work together to both make the investment and be the customer, you know, that is a winning combination for both the startup and the banks that are participating.
Well, we're going to add to your perspective some outside investors. Tell us about the interviews that we have coming up for the rest of the show.
Yeah, so the at segment. So really excited. First, we have Kat Utecht, who is managing partner at Core Innovation Capital. And Kat has a really interesting perspective because she leans in hard to two of the most heavily regulated spaces, financial services and healthcare, and has built a really interesting portfolio. And then in the back half, after the break, we're going to hear from Matt Harris, who I've had the good fortune of knowing for going pretty close to 2 decades now. And he was one of the first VCs who really looked at financial services and fintech and said, you know what? You know, this is a space that I'm both going to make my home, and really leaned in. And I would say it helped really drive the fintech space into the mainstream. Now it's one of the hottest category VCs look at. And I think in no small part, that's been driven by great VCs like these two. Well, welcome, Kat Utecht, managing partner at Core Innovation Capital. Welcome to Breaking Banks. Excited to finally have you on the show.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me, Jason.
Now, you've had your fingers in around fintech and financial services since your days with GE Capital, then especially at Raymond James, where you were in the financial services group. You know, what was your biggest surprise when you switched over from either the corporate finance side and the investment banking to, you know, being a venture investor?
Yeah. So yeah, we've been doing fintech well before it was hot, and actually even before it was cool. So between when I was at GE and a banker, I co-founded and was CEO of a company. So I really understood a lot of the startup side and have a lot of empathy for entrepreneurs. Obviously going into investing and institutional investing was different. I had been angel investing. So it's just like, it's a lot to learn. You don't understand, like, why would some people invest in companies? Why would they not? And you realize it's not just as simple as the team product market. That's what I'm looking for. There's a lot of nuances into it, and a lot of reasons like why we do deals and why we don't.
Now, I wish there was a way you could measure for the luck quotient. Maybe take the entrepreneurs to Vegas and, you know, just see how lucky they are too, because so much of it does seem to require that. What other intangibles do you look for, if not just the team and product and market fit?
Yeah, so what's great is actually we do take entrepreneurs to Vegas a lot, Money 2020, InsureTech Connect. So we can see how lucky they are, but you're right. Luck and time is actually a lot of it. You know, the team, we always start with the same question is, what's your background? What did your parents do? You know, what led you to where you are? What's the genesis of the idea? I think you have to look, right, there's like a baseline of intelligence you need to do this, but you don't have to be a rocket scientist. A lot of it has to do with like persistence and grit, and really passion for whatever the person is solving. So, you know, when looking at team, it's a lot more nuanced than just looking at a resume. And we really love to get the backstory of why people are doing what they're doing. You know, the market is always an interesting question, because if you're doing something new, you might be creating a complete new market that's never existed before. So if you look at the past, you have to say, and you know, we just made an investment in a company where the market will look small, but we think what they're building and the marketplace they're building will actually redefine how the whole industry works. So you have to be a little bit creative when you're thinking about, you know, what the market is. And then, you know, with the product, and depending on it, how early it is, we really look at, again, it goes back to the team, like what exists now, that's a reflection of the team. And we know that the product and service will evolve. And we also look for a team that's like flexible enough and that doesn't fall so in love with their own ideas that are cool to evolve their product or service.
Now, that's a good segue, because one of the things that sets core innovation apart, at least in my mind, is your focus on early stage, whether that be seed or series A. And I know you're fond of saying, you know, series A is the new seed, or seed is the new series A. But, you know, since early stage is challenging in general, what's especially challenging for that in fintech?
Yeah, so fintech's one of the few industries where, like, you can't just take, you know, two guys or two gals in the garage and just decide you're going to start a fintech company. The ecosystem's very complex. There's a lot of ingrained players. It's a lot of the stuff we're investing in is highly regulated. So you really have to understand how fintech works. You have to understand the regulations. And sometimes it can take you a year or 2 years to get all the proper licenses that you need. A lot of things you need state by state licenses, and not just like one large federal. And there are certain things, like if you're going to become a bank or buy one, you need to have experience there. The government's just not just going to give you a license if you've come from nowhere. So really is building the right teams and really understanding what the regulatory framework is and preparing for that. So again, it sometimes can take longer and actually on average takes longer to build a fintech company. Can also take a lot longer to launch a fintech company. So we're looking for teams that really understand that environment, and you know, we're cool with hacking a lot in early stage startups, but we have zero tolerance policy for hacking any type of regulation. So we're looking for people that like understand and know, you know, and know the frameworks and can work around and with it.
Well, and it's not just the entrepreneurs that need to learn that. I think what sets Core apart is a partner there, and what sets apart great fintech investors are the ones who understand you can't hack the finance. You know, I wish I had, you know, had a dollar or, you know, a fraction of a Bitcoin or a Satoshi for every time I hear, oh, we're going to take the Uber strategy and we're just going to scale and they're going to have to work for us. Right. And I'm like horrified. Yeah. I'm like, yeah.
It's so funny you said that, because so like one, like, right, this is not the hotel lobby. This is not the taxi industry. You know, the government will shut you down. Two, it's funny that you mentioned Bitcoin, because I was thinking, you know, what scares me about a bunch of these entrepreneurs and some really smart people are getting into crypto. They have no idea about financial services. And they say all the time, you can take really smart people if they've been successful in certain industries or certain things, they think they'll be successful somewhere else. It is hard to be successful in fintech, especially if you really don't understand this environment. And from some of these entrepreneurs' past experiences, they don't get it. So they don't get like that the SEC can shut you down, right? That the OCC, the Fed, like these people actually really, really matter. And again, it's not like the taxi union. So it's definitely been interesting to watch.
Well, I mean, along those lines, I was trying to explain to VC over, let's just say within the last year, because I don't want to give too much away, that a prepaid account is different than a checking account, and you therefore cannot market it as a checking account, and that you can actually get shut down. They're like, well, I mean, surely they wouldn't shut you down. They would just give you a warning. And it's like, you know, the OCC doesn't really do a lot of warnings. That isn't really one of their remedies in a regulatory environment. Are there other kind of, what other craziness have you seen that would be enlightening for both the entrepreneurs, and especially since we have a lot of incumbents that are interested in investing in the space? What are some of the surprises that you've seen entrepreneurs say in the space?
So many funny surprises. But we've seen a bunch of entrepreneurs that put the word bank in their name to start with. And we're like, oh, you can't do that. Like, they'll shut you down. Unless you're actually a bank, you can't call yourself a bank. So we've seen some stuff like that. And then I think people just don't understand, you know, like I said, a lot of the regulatory environment, and they do get shut down and then have to fix what they're doing. I think I've been surprised to see a lot of what has gone on in some of the cryptos and in some of the pre-sales of ICOs. It's been kind of disturbing to me to see either entrepreneurs that I think are normally long-term and trying to create real value and real businesses do things that look more like get rich quick schemes. It's been upsetting to see, right? It's been upsetting to see investors. Like, there's no way I should be able to participate in a pre-sale and then 2 weeks later, sell my stake at, you know, a 4 to 10x. I've created no value. Like, it doesn't make sense. I think that's where, you know, government's going to have problems with that, and they should, because you can't have people making, you know, 4 to 10x their money or any kind of multiple, and then selling their stake to just like regular retail investors that don't understand what's going on. And, you know, it's not a good enough excuse saying like, we didn't understand the rules. I mean, you should just like intuitive basis, you shouldn't be making that much money for nothing. I think that, you know, people will actually go to jail, and this might be one of the first times we see like investors and entrepreneurs going to jail for just breaking the rules and doing things that were really like get rich quick type things. So that's been in the last like year, that's the most upsetting thing I've seen, and where sometimes I'm like, whoa, this is not, it doesn't feel like the, you know, venture capitalist entrepreneurs that I know. And it's been disturbing to see some of that.
So if those are some of the areas that disturb you and are overplayed, what areas are you focused on and most excited about?
Yeah, so still in crypto, we think there will be a phoenix. So as much as, you know, 95% of what we're seeing are scams or issuing securities regulations, I think there's some really great companies that will come out of it. So we do spend a lot of time there. I think another area that we're really interested in is health insurance. So when we look at, what we're really looking at is a household GDP, and how can you increase that household GDP? Where are most of their costs going? And a significant amount of a household's cost is going into healthcare and health insurance. We've always been interested in insurance. We've done things in P&C and auto and life. And you know, we've started in the last couple of years doing a lot more in health. We've made 4 investments there so far, and I think we have several others that are going to be on tap. It's just something that needs to be fixed. And I think if you look at just the whole U.S. economy, it's a serious problem. It's a serious cost for the government. And they've tried to effectively change how the healthcare system works, and I think not quite successfully. So we're looking at private solutions and solutions that we think might be better than what's existed so far. And in the end, you know, I think it'll end up being better for the country as a whole, being better for like individuals and households. And then obviously that means our companies can be big winners, and thus we'll be big winners.
Great. Well, in the last minute here, any, you know, advice or words of wisdom for our aspiring fintech entrepreneurs or intrapreneurs as they're looking to overhaul the system, especially at some of these intersections that you talked about where insurance meets healthcare meets the fintech application?
Yeah, make sure you have the right people on your team. So, right, you have to understand healthcare, you have to understand insurance, you have to understand the regulations. You have to be able to hire in these places, understand what's been tried, maybe why that hasn't worked, why maybe now is different and the time is different. So I think spend a lot of time looking at what's worked, what hasn't, and hiring the right people, right? Like in the end, it's all about the people and hiring. And that's where most of our teams are spending time. So I think, you know, as you decide to tackle an issue, make sure that there's enough people in this space that you might know that you can pull onto your team.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us, Kat. Look forward to having you on the show, hopefully sometime again soon, but really appreciate you sharing your words of wisdom with everyone.
Yeah, thanks for your time. I'll roll some dice with you in Vegas soon.
All right, look forward to it.
In a world where banking fraud and cybercrime reign supreme, it's time for NetGuardian. Machine language technology built for banks to beat fraud in real time. NetGuardians.ch.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. The second half of today's show is sponsored by Medici. They've partnered with FedFizz, the bank data specialist, to create a new solution, the FI Data Pack. This provides proprietary ratings, financial metrics, and context for every bank and credit union in the U.S. to empower your sales and market team to focus on identifying the perfect financial institution for your next sale. Use code PROVOKE to receive a discount at gomedici.com/breakingbanks. Now on with our interview with Matt Harris.
So very excited to have Matt Harris, Managing Director, lead for the New York office, and one of the earliest venture capitalists that I know, at least, to make fintech a very big focus. And so, Matt, as I was actually prepping for this, do you know that we've actually known each other for over 18 years already?
That, you know, is shocking on one hand, but given how long each of us has been dedicated to this endeavor, it actually makes perfect sense.
So back when we first met, you were one of the founders of Village Ventures, and I was focused on Rock Maple. You were very much a generalist. I had a little bit more emphasis on things that sell to banks, just based on my background from Monitor. What made you shift your focus to financial technology?
So I sort of got the fintech bug very early in my career. And then at Village, I did a couple early financial technology investments, as you point out, among a number of things I was doing. And then I just realized that if I wanted to have a serious career in venture capital, I kind of needed to stand for something. I needed to have something distinctive to hang my hat on. And to me, I thought the opportunity in financial innovation was real. And at that time, there were so few people focused on it that I kind of liked the ratio. It felt like a space where I could be one of the leaders.
So, do you still remember the first fintech deal you looked at? Probably not the first one you did, but do you still remember what that first deal was and what was your reaction to it?
Well, that's a hell of a question. I think I did the first fintech deal I looked at Village Ventures as it happened. I remember it therefore pretty intensely. It was a company called Blue Tarp. Still exists. Based in Portland, Maine, focused on commercial B2B payments, you know, and actually a space that I remain very interested in. They're focused on building materials. So they help contractors buy from building material dealers and basically move those transactions from trade credit onto a more traditional B2B procurement card. And I remember vividly meeting with the founders were two brothers, and it was sort of a tutorial on the four-party payments model and how it could look different in a vertically focused segment, like has been true, for instance, in the fuel card category for three decades. And I just remember feeling so energized about how much there was to learn about payments And so I made a seed investment in Blue Tarp and served on that board for many years.
Yeah. Well, and so that must have been a very good primer because you did quite a bit around payments, you know, following after that. So it didn't scare you away, at least. What was kind of the biggest surprise actually doing a financial service or a fintech investment?
You know, it was a series of surprises. So the next fintech deal I did was a company called Gerson Lerman Group, or GLG, which is an expert network that at the time was serving the hedge fund community. And so the first surprise for me about fintech in the 2000s was how few people were interested. You know, GLG, for instance, was incredibly profitable, very fast growing. Bessemer ultimately ended up investing, but it was really hard to get venture interest in companies that were serving, in their case, the asset management industry. And similarly with Blue Tarp, again, the margins were incredible. The opportunity was huge. And you go to a VC in 2004, 2005 and talk about a payments company, and they would basically just say, well, you know, doesn't Visa just do that? You know, there's sort of just this lack of a mental model for what an entrepreneur could do. So that was surprising. And then, you know, on the more unfortunate surprise list, I would say an 08 ran around, came around, and
that little thing
sort of,
yeah,
it started to explain a little bit why people were somewhat leery of financial services businesses. I mean, it was a really tough time for a lot of those companies. Anyone who had balance sheet exposure, Blue Tarp is an example. We had a company called On Deck. And those were, you know, daily board calls, worrying about liquidity, worrying about credit risk. And then with companies like GLG, worrying about, you know, the contraction of your customer base and then regulatory issues that loomed. And for me, the first decade of investing in fintech was that steep learning curve of first learning the opportunity set and how much you could do if you bothered to dig deep into some of these subsectors. And then second, really the painful process of understanding when things go wrong, how badly wrong they can go when you've got, you know, regulatory exposure and capital exposure and credit exposure.
Yeah. I mean, those are definitely, a startup is hard enough to do. And when you add things like that into your model, you know, from just also the pace that things can move when you have to deal with regulatory and compliance and with bank partners, you know, your cycle time is out of whack. And I think it's funny, you know, that you call out that, you know, back in, you know, 07, 08, not everyone was interested in fintech. In fact, most weren't. And I won't use him by name because we both know this VC on the West Coast who has quite a great reputation. But when we were out pitching Perk Street, we described it as fintech. He looked at us and was very proud of this joke. He goes, "Fintech, does that have to do with fish?" And now you look at, you know, right? So like the idea of explaining, and I, you know, Josh and Shamir and I talked about this, you know, quite a bit in our parallel evolution too, explaining to venture investors why someone uses a debit card, right? Like deer in headlights of the, why would anyone ever use a debit card? That's crazy. You know, and the same could be said of like an On Deck. Why would anyone get a loan, you know, online and pay at some of those rates? That I think not just our industry, but, you know, the incumbents sometimes are so disconnected from what the customer actually needs. Do you feel like that's getting any better, or is it still a pervasive problem?
I think it has gotten better and almost to the point of being overshoot. I would say, you know, I think the debit card based businesses or lending businesses in particular, but even also wealth management businesses, asset management businesses, went from being obscure and out of favor and confusing, you know, 6 or 7, to I think at a peak in maybe 13 or 14, the opposite was true. That, you know, yeah, even if the fundamental economics never made sense and never would, there were companies getting funded at obscene valuations simply because financial services disruption became so au courant. And so that was actually painful to live through as well. I'm sure for you, certainly for me, that, you know, some of this stuff just never made any sense. And, And a lot of those excesses actually have been wrung out to a certain extent, or at least have shifted to crypto land.
They're chasing something else now, right? There's still too many of those companies hanging around, but there's the new latest and greatest to be pursuing. So since you brought up, you know, kind of the crypto and the blockchain side, you know, have you been looking in that space? What have you found interesting? And, you know, what are you shying away from?
Well, I have been intrigued by Bitcoin itself since inception. Actually, this guy, Gavin Andreessen, who took over from Satoshi, had been CTO of one of my companies in the 90s. So I'd known him since the very beginning, and I wasn't smart enough to buy a lot of Bitcoin in the very, very early days. But it always has seemed to me to be this logic that there would be a new non-fiat store of value is at least as logical as gold is, which is to say, not very, but you can see why it would be desirable given human psychology. And so I've always been long Bitcoin without any price targets or timing, just sort of something I want to be exposed to. And then at the very other end of the spectrum, I'm intrigued by the idea of open source protocol with internal monetization tokens. I can see that working. You know, open source has worked for a long time without a monetization motivation. And you wonder, like, would Linux have been even more successful had it had a token? Would some of the open source projects that we, you know, many of our systems run on today have been even more successful against their commercial counterparts if the teams working on them had had financial motivation? I think it's possible that they would have. And so I can see where in certain cases these distributed applications with internal utility tokens could actually take, you know, financial and activity share away from incumbents. And that intrigues me. It feels extremely futuristic. But of course we're in the business of trying to predict that future. So those are two things that I am drawn to. I think Bitcoin is an asset class, and people seem interested in trading other crypto assets. And so collectively there's a couple hundred billion of market cap that people are trading, and there'll be elements of market structure that come together around that. And we've invested in some of those. And then I pay careful attention to distributed apps, although I think it's hard to know which ones will actually catch on. And so we've been cautious. I think where I've been less enthusiastic is anything to do with banking. So the idea that, you know, that payments is going to fundamentally change, or capital markets are going to fundamentally change because of this database architecture, or because of any particular crypto asset, seems extremely far-fetched to me.
So let me delve into that. So do you think banking as a whole is going to change, or the fact that just because we have crypto or blockchain, you know, we're not going to see exchanges go away, we're not going to see payment networks go away? Or would you categorize banking as a whole, do you still think is relatively safe?
I wouldn't say that banking is safe, but I don't think the threats have anything to do with blockchain.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. If anything, I think the banks are going to be more successful because they can leverage blockchain and some of these things, that they're the ones who are going to benefit the most from blockchain. You know, if you look at like what Barclays is doing internally, or Deutsche Bank, and the efficiencies that they're gaining out of it versus, you know, this, you know, startup coming out and developing a blockchain-based, you know, settlement that suddenly everyone was going to believe in.
Right. I think regardless of the database architecture, you know, if startups come in and pitch us that they're trying to replace Visa or MasterCard, or trying to replace the DTCC on the capital market side, it's just really sloggy and super improbable. And blockchain doesn't change that fact. You know, it's as much or more a social issue as it is a technological one. And the idea that blockchain is some kind of magic wand is obviously preposterous. So, I end up, you know, I think banks have much to be concerned about. I think they have vigorous, entrepreneurially led, technologically sophisticated competitors like never before across all their businesses. But blockchain has nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Well, I'm fond now of saying, you know, blockchain is a tool. You'd never go hire a hammer company, right? You'd hire a construction company. So why are we talking about blockchain and AI as if they're anything other than a means? They're certainly not the end. And therefore, you can't say blockchain is what finally breaks banks. So I think one of your greatest contributions to the industry, by the way, is you're coining the term Finsurgency, which I dutifully try and give you credit for. You know, I've been using it since I think 2008 was the first time you used that when we were talking about both what Perk Street and Bank Simple were trying to do. So if you were an incumbent, how would you think about defending or extending yourself in the midst of this Finsurgency that's going on?
Well, I do think you have these Finsurgents, and thank you for that. You're too kind. Who are trying to steal market share from banks, whether that be companies like Square, who have already taken a ton of share on the merchant acquiring side, who are now coming after consumers with Square Cash and debit card capabilities, et cetera, or obviously on the lending side, legions of companies that have both new and old value propositions, but that are delivered elegantly and digitally. So you've got these head-on competitors that some segments of your customer base are going to prefer. But you've also got new vendors. This is what I think is so exciting and you know, maybe net neutral for banks, maybe net positive, is that if you can figure out procurement and compliance, you've got people trying to help you that are not engineers you've had access to in the past.
Yep.
Because for every Silicon Valley company that's got a crazy idea to bring down the banks, there's, in my experience, two or three who want to use these new technologies and this great talent to do things for you that FIS and Fiserv and Jack Henry are just never going to get to. And so the bad box for banks is to, you know, feel threatened by these new competitors, but not feel emboldened to try the new vendors. Because I think that's the eventual road to ruin, particularly for banks outside of the top 5 or 10 who simply don't have the budgets to build the delightful thing themselves, you know, even if they had the capability. Time will tell whether the top 5 to 10 even have the capability to do it themselves. But surely bank number 50 doesn't.
You are not going to out app JPMorgan Chase right now or a Capital One. You might be able to pick a slice and say, hey, I can apply technology, probably with a partner, by the way, but you know, I can do something special for a segment of my customers, but not universally. They're just throwing way too much at it.
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, bankers who've been doing this 30 years, they used to have geographic barriers to entry that no longer exist. I mean, it used to legitimately be the case that within a trading area, a bank would have 3 or 4 competitors, or maybe they'd have 15, but it wasn't a major money center bank generally. They didn't have to worry about that because of restrictions on branching and just because of how banking worked. It was a very local business. And it's not a local business anymore. So the bigger threat, I think, for a regional bank, the single biggest threat is actually JP Morgan. And Silicon Valley is somewhere on the list, but the fact that your territory can be invaded by the big guys now with impunity is what's making life so difficult.
Yeah, I just had this conversation with the president of a bank in Hawaii last week, where you know the Pacific Ocean made a pretty good moat for them if you weren't going to go build and commit to, you know, putting branches on multiple of the islands to get the coverage. And they're realizing, now that we're swimming in a digital ocean, that no longer is a barrier to their competition.
Yeah. And it's really hard to change the thinking of, you know, local competition and what sports team you're going to sponsor and how do you, you know, become a local influencer to thinking about product more than local marketing tactics as the core basis of competition. And I think many executives are not going to be able to make that leap. And therefore, many institutions are not going to be able to make that leap.
Yeah. And I love how you pull out the notion of the nature of competition, but I think they also need to wake up to the type of business model. Not only are the strategies and tactics changing, but down to its very core on how you think about the business you're in. You know, when I hear a top five bank CEO saying that Amazon's never going to be a bank because it's too complex, you know, I just want to turn and say, no, they're never going to be a bank because they realize they don't need to be a bank. And by the way, they're not trying to be a bank because that's not their business, but they're definitely going to do banking services because it helps them sell more stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think the banks talk a lot about data. And, you know, data is the new oil and AI and what have you. But there's a deeper sense in which they don't actually understand the value of the data they have. You know, I mean, there are entrepreneurs who are like working to sell services to banks to help them understand how their DDA data could help inform their credit decisioning to lend to those very same customers. And it's like, yep. That, how is that still not an obvious part of every bank strategy? Like, think how much you know about your customers, and yet when you think about lending to them or offering them a credit card, you're not leveraging any of that stuff for propensity to adopt those new products or suitability or likelihood of repayment or what have you. And if you're Amazon, that intuitive sense of what the data is worth, you know, you're starting on third base.
Well, and Amazon uses it to tailor it in a way that it's actually not invasive. I actually like that they recommend products to me. But if I get one more direct mail product from a major bank trying to offer me additional credit, you know, for my business, which I don't need, nor do I want, nor will I ever take out, it's like, you have an existing relationship with me, existing bank, Chase. How come you don't use that, you know, to better tailor an offer for me? So, you know, as we come to a close of this segment, at least, I'd love, you know, as you look to the future, you've had a good run over the last 18 years focused on this space. What do you think is up next? And, you know, if you could say over the next 3 to 5, what's that unexpected surprise that you're betting on?
Well, I've been spending a lot of time in real estate technology. And it certainly has captured and is keeping my attention. And it's part of it is like, it's all of fintech with just a different angle. There's a lending angle, there's a meaningful payments angle, there's a asset management angle, an investing angle, an insurance angle. It's making me think that there are other industries. If you think about industry that just, you turn it 90 degrees and you see all the subsegments of fintech and how they affect it. I'm sort of like, isn't that true of healthcare also? Like, isn't that true of supply chain and logistics? Like, doesn't every industry have these fintech problems and fintech opportunities? And I, you know, 18 years in, as you point out, I've the only, you know, interesting and special thing about me, if anything, is that I do this one thing. And so the last thing I want to do is do less of it or do it in any diluted way. But it's a little bit how software has started changing every industry. It feels to me like when you pick up one of these rocks, one rock, for example, being real estate, and you look under it, like you see a lot of fintech problems. And so the things that I'm most interested in now are a little bit less sort of pure play native payments problems or insurtech problems, et cetera, and more of these intersectional areas where you get another huge chunk of the economy And it's where it meets financial services that there's still a lot of paper and inefficiency and analog and risk and cost that can be solved. So I think the way in which this continues to be the gift that keeps on giving is thinking about these intersections of our next chapter.
Well, and it kind of takes that argument I was making around blockchain and AI are means and not an end. We should actually apply that to our industry as a whole, that you know, the reason we go to banks was we needed the services they provide. There's nothing that says I need a bank, right? I don't go say I need a mortgage. I need a house. I need a way to finance it. It's embedded in what you just described, and that might be the next wave of what we're saying. So if people don't follow Matt on Twitter, it's a great place to find him. It's Matt C. Harris at Twitter, if I'm not mistaken. And also Finsurgency.com has what, 10 years of content up there at this point in terms of what you've written on? One of my go-to sources, and always enjoy that. Thank you for joining us today, Matt, and look forward to hopefully having you on the show again in the very near future.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks to Kat Utrecht and Matt Harris for joining us. We always appreciate your feedback and suggestions, so hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm. If you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment, drop us a line there as well. And before you jump to that next podcast, please give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps others find the show. And don't forget, you can listen to all of our more than 250 shows now, plus episodes from my Serial Entrepreneur podcast, Jason's FinTech 5, and Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for more of the latest in fintech news.